Washington has been consumed with the fight to replace Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. And our U.S. Senator, Charles Grassley, is one of those at the center of the partisan firestorm. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We'll start the hour with Dennis Goldford of Drake University talking about the Supreme Court battle and the presidential campaign. Also on the program, privatizing Iowa's Medicaid management. University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld faces critics at a public forum. How this election's anti-immigrant tone is even making itself heard at Iowa high school basketball games. And why a Des Moines high school gets a gender-neutral bathroom. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Since Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia's death, that was 2 weeks ago, Washington has been consumed with a fight over his replacement. And as chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa is one of those at the center of this partisan firestorm. Grassley and other Senate Republicans say there will be no new Supreme Court justice until President Obama is out of office, and that they will block any nominee Obama puts forward. No hearings, no vote, no matter who the president names. Now, President Obama is scheduled to meet with Senator Grassley, also with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, on Tuesday of next week. Dennis Goldford of Drake University joins me now to talk about this battle over Scalia's replacement and Grassley's role in it. Dennis Goldford is professor of political science at Drake University in Des Moines and Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute. Dennis, welcome to the program.
Always glad to be here.
Let me read the statement, the short statement that Grassley put out yesterday about his meeting with the president coming next week. On Tuesday, we will meet with the president at the White House. We look forward to reiterating to him directly that the American people will be heard and the next Supreme Court justice will be determined once the elections are complete and the next president has been sworn into office. And we welcome the opportunity to further discuss matters of mutual interest, like the drug epidemic that's tearing communities apart across our country. So, Dennis, is the president really hoping to convince McConnell and Grassley to change their minds? Or is there something else behind this meeting?
Well, I think he's trying to set them up, and they're allowing him to do that. I mean, both parties, when they've dealt with this issue of nominations, have been trying to speak at the level of high principle. The quote you just read from Senator Grassley illustrates that. But it's simply putting lipstick on a pig. Both parties are dressing up in the sound of high principle what's actually raw partisan interest. Senator Grassley has made this point, but in New York Times column on Thursday, for example, in response to this idea that judges' nominations shouldn't proceed in an election year, Senator Grassley was quoted in saying in 2008, that's just plain bunk. The reality is that the Senate has never stopped confirming judicial nominees during the last few months of a president's term. Now, that was Senator Grassley with a Republican president. So this is not the level of high principle, and the Democrats have been guilty of this as well. It's simply dressing up in principle what is simply partisan self-interest.
Okay, what do you make, though, of each side's argument in this case, if we can separate it from, Grassley has also been this week quoting Joe Biden quite a bit from the 1990s. The Democrats say, hey, Senate, do your constitutional duty here. Advise and consent on the nominee. The GOP says let the American people decide. Grassley also says the Senate's advice and consent role stated in our U.S. Constitution includes the ability to not do that.
Well, I think as a matter of the powers of the Senate, yes, the president can nominate someone to any position, an ambassadorship or to a judgeship of this sort, and the Senate is fully within its constitutional powers to refuse to consider it. So there's no question at all about that. Now, is it wise or is it the right thing to do? That's a second issue. As I said, the Democrats have been guilty of this in the past as well. The argument that we should hear from the American people is flawed on two grounds. The first is, number one, that the country already heard from the American people in November of 2012. They reelected Barack Obama, to the joy of some, to the consternation of others, and he has certain powers and responsibilities as president. Number two, the Constitution simply does not provide for the American people to have any kind of direct voice in the nomination and confirmation of judgeships. That's the whole idea of an independent judiciary, which is not subject to electoral control or accountability. That's what the framers set up. So once again, you have a situation in which both sides have been, and right now it's the Republicans, using a matter of what they claim to be high principle in order to pursue their own particular partisan interest.
Do you have any idea who's winning in the court of public opinion nationally and here in Iowa on this question?
Well, I'm not sure about Iowa specifically. I know I did see a reputable national poll during the week this all came out that suggested that 56% of the American public want the Senate to hold confirmation hearings, 38% do not, and 6%, whatever that difference is, are simply undecided or don't know. So everybody dresses up his own position in the name of the American people, but in this particular case, I'm not sure what American people the Republicans are referring to beyond other Republicans.
If the Republicans get their way, the earliest a ninth justice could be in place would be the spring of 2017, over a year from now. I wonder if you know if there's any precedent for what is happening in terms of the length of this delay.
I think the longest it's taken for a justice to be confirmed is, I believe it's about 125 days, so about 4 months, something like that. We have to remember that the Supreme Court has had as many as 10 members, that was in the 1790s, as many as six, that was in the 1790s, and it's had as many as 10, and it was an act of Congress in 1869, I believe, that fixed the number of justices on the Supreme Court at 9. So we've had that ever since then, even in opposition to Franklin Roosevelt's court-packing plan in the 1930s. So we've had the 9 justices, but there have been times, of course, when under the current court, many cases in which one or more of the justices has recused himself because of potential conflict of interest. So the court can function and does function with only 8 justices, perhaps 7 at some point, I can't recall specifically. It just causes some difficulties in the case of a 4-4 tie.
Mm-hmm. Back to the question of our U.S. Senator Grassley and his perspective. He's 82 years old, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, which, of course, oversees the confirmation process for court appointees. How do you see this challenge specifically for Grassley at this stage in his congressional career?
Well, you know, Senator Grassley has always been an electoral force of nature. He's, of course, been in the Congress since 1974, January of 75, so he's been there 40 years. He's been unstoppable. I think he won his Senate seat in 1980 first with about 54% of the vote. He's never had less than 60% and sometimes had as much as 65 or close to 70% in some reelection bid. So he's always been this electoral colossus that's bestrode the state of Iowa. And so, the Democrats can make a claim, of course, that he is not fulfilling his function or he's bowing to pressure from some of the more extreme members of his conference in the Senate. The best Democrats can hope for is to try to pick away independent support for Senator Grassley. He's always had strong support among independents in Iowa to go with that Republican base. But it's always an uphill fight to go against Chuck Grassley, but it doesn't make it absolutely impossible.
Mm-hmm. We heard this week Patty Judge, a former Iowa lieutenant governor, also former Iowa Secretary of Agriculture, told the Des Moines Register she's thinking about running against Grassley when asked about that. Is she and other Democrats, I guess you may have just answered it, are they having pipe dreams?
Well, I wouldn't want to discourage them, but it's a tough challenge. On the other hand, one of the reasons why this has become such a big issue, aside from the jurisprudential dimension of it, that a lot of hot-button issues turn on control of this seat, is that both parties will use this to gin up their base. And Republicans will use it to try to make sure more Republicans turn out to vote. So will the Democrats. But on the other hand, Republicans in Iowa and nationwide already vote at a pretty high rate. It's the Democrats who have constituencies that tend not to vote as regularly. So it wouldn't be a wash if they both gin up their base, their voters. Democrats would tend to benefit more if they can make an issue out of it and excite their supporters to turn out to vote.
So this is not only has repercussions for the presidential election, but also control of the Senate.
Yes, it does. If five seats were to move into the Democratic column, and I think this next year there are 24 Republican seats up for re-election and only 10 Democratic seats up for re-election. The advantage will flip back to the Republicans in 2018. But Republicans have to defend a lot more seats this time around. If the Democrats capture five seats, which is not to say that would be easy, they would regain control of the Senate. If the Democrats captured four seats and a Democratic president were elected with the vice president's tie-breaking vote, the Democrats would control the Senate. So, yes, this, in fact, could affect not just the presidential race, but the U.S. Senate race.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about the GOP debate last night. What stood out for you most about the last GOP debate before Super Tuesday?
It was a food fight, or it was like an event at, what's the program, the Worldwide Wrestling Entertainment or whatever that is, professional wrestling with people throwing chairs and things like that, the verbal version of that. It was just, at some points, I just wanted to hit the mute button. But clearly, Senators Rubio and Cruz were attempting to finally go after Donald Trump because I wouldn't say anything's inevitable in politics, but I think that he's just not been stoppable yet. And if Cruz and Rubio don't do well on Super Tuesday, then that train is leaving the station.
Mm-hmm. What about Trump's claim? He made it last night as well, that he is broadening the Republican Party. I don't know. He may have even said in the way that Ronald Reagan did.
Well, Trump is attracting some voters who have been, say, working-class Democrats or especially working-class independents and other middle-class folks, people who've been somewhat alienated from the political process. And, you know, as I've said, Trump represents people who are simply sick and tired of politics and politicians as usual, and he's attempting to give them a voice and channel their anger. And angry people vote. And so he can make this claim. We don't have any hard data on this yet, at least in nationwide sense. But that's always been the question. If he gets all these folks to turn out, particularly those who have not been voting in the past, then he could say he's broadening the Republican Party. Republicans argue, however, that he's not very Republican, and what he's doing is not broadening the party, but transforming or subverting the party.
Depending on how Super Tuesday turns out, we're likely to see others drop out. Would we see Kasich and Carson? Is this their last stand?
Well, the question is, how long does their money hold out? I mean, Kasich supposedly is trying to get to the Ohio primary and the Midwestern states as of the middle of March. Carson, I guess he's still got some money. It's not sure how much he's got to continue with. On the other hand, there have been some reports that he's so ticked at Cruz for his campaign's tactics against Carson here in Iowa that he's just staying in for spite, because the assumption is that Carson supporters might well gravitate to Cruz more than any of the other candidates.
We've got a couple minutes left, of course. Quickly, let's go to the Democratic side. What do you see in the matchup between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders ahead of the South Carolina primary this weekend and Super Tuesday?
Right. There's still the generational divide that older voters, wealthier voters tend to support Hillary Clinton. Younger voters in particular tend to support Bernie Sanders. While there's been some minority support for Sanders, Hillary Clinton still gets more of that. So the question has always been, even before the process started here in Iowa, if Sanders were to win Iowa, and of course he basically was in a virtual tie with Hillary Clinton, and if he were to win New Hampshire as well, that's great, but where does he go after that? Because so many of the Democratic primaries involve electorates that are much more demographically diverse than anything that Sanders has had to deal with before. And African-American voters have always been staunch Clinton supporters. They were until Barack Obama here in Iowa showed that he could win white votes. And now that he's leaving office and Hillary Clinton's wrapping herself around his legacy, they're going to go back, by and large, to Hillary Clinton. So the question is, can Sanders make a breakthrough in this support that we would assume would go to Hillary Clinton?
Mm-hmm. And your guess on that, your educated guess?
My educated guess would be no. But the problem for Hillary Clinton is, if in fact she gets the nomination, what happens to these enthusiastic, especially new to the process, Sanders voters? Does he convince them? Could he convince them? Would he be willing to convince them that while he didn't win, she's still preferable to the Republican alternative? Or would he, if he chose not to convince them, would they just sit on their hands and stay home Election Day, and she can't win without that support?
What about Clinton bringing him into her tent, as a Barack Obama did to Hillary Clinton?
Well, it's hard to see him in a vice president's position, but you never know.
Or in the administration.
Well, in a cabinet position or something like that. But, you know, when you start to wonder about his particular expertise, I know he chaired, the Veterans Affairs Committee for a while. So, he could maybe be a secretary of Veterans Administration. But I don't know how much of a policy person he is as much of a political person with his message. I mean, that's his strength and his weakness, the one constant message he's laid out. It's his strength because it's clear what he stands for. It's his weakness because he doesn't talk about anything else like foreign policy and national security.
Dennis, we have to go.
Sure.
Thank you. Never enough time.
But
there is never enough time for politics. Dennis Goldford, professor of political science at Drake University, Flansburg Fellow for the Harkin Institute. Always a pleasure to speak with you, Dennis.
Thanks a lot.
Glad you're along for the ride on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. On Friday, we like to have quick conversations to wrap up the week. The Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services have given the final okay for Iowa to proceed with plans to privatize management of the state's Medicaid system. This is a switch from state management to private management that is planned to take effect on the 1st of April. Brian Caskey joins us again, Associate Professor of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Hello, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. So we got this decision from CMS. This is the federal agency within the United States Department of Health and Human Services. What does it mean for the state?
Well, it effectively means we continue to move forward as planned, and that is services will officially be launched July 1st, and up until that time, the state will continue to engage in their efforts to get people ready. So this allows both providers and beneficiaries a little more time to learn what will be happening, also to learn which plans they may decide to choose. If they do not make a choice, of course, they will be assigned to a plan, and then that will take effect on July 1st as well. The state has actually made a number of good steps forward in this regard. For example, at the upcoming Governor's Conference on Aging, they've already scheduled a number of the providers, the companies who have won the awards, to come in and present to those who are working in the aging network about the different programs and services that they will help support with the implementation of this waiver program.
Mm-hmm. In our talk shows about this, and some of which you have been involved in, we have people calling in, writing in, very concerned people affected by Medicaid and often confused. So that confusion will dissipate as these steps are taken?
Well, I certainly hope so. And I want to remind people that we have been moving in the direction to manage care for quite some time in this state. For over actually 20 years now, the Medicaid program has relied on managed care companies to help them deliver services. So with that history in mind, I hope it won't be such a tremendous shock to the system.
Mm-hmm. I know we talked about oversight in previous conversations. Lawmakers in Iowa still talking about oversight. Given what you know about these privatization plans and also how they played out in other states, what sorts of oversight measures do you think Iowa's legislature should be looking at?
Well, oversight certainly is important. Just as we have boards and other officials who provide oversight of our public schools, we should have oversight of our public health care system, especially when we're about to move it in entirety to private organizations. In fact, the Senate Finance Committee commissioned a report by the Government Accountability Office that concluded that such oversight was a necessary condition to ensure integrity of these programs. And it's also a requirement that CMS makes in approving the waiver that there is an oversight plan in place.
Mm-hmm. Are there models in states that have been privatized in their management that are particularly effective or less effective? For instance, if one of the managed care organizations is found to be failing in one facet of its service, what would be a good process to correct that?
That's a good point. And what I would suggest is that we start by looking at the GAO reports. These reports were pretty thorough in what they examined and also gave good insights and statements about what we could do going forward. We also could look at other states. They've made reference to 40 other states having experience in moving in their Medicaid programs into managed care arenas. It might be prudent of us to take a look at some of those states, especially the three or four that have moved so wholeheartedly into a private arrangement with managed care companies. And it would be nice to learn what they found out along the way, both good and bad. And last, I think it's important that we give proper support to whatever state authority is charged with this job of maintaining oversight of the managed care contracts. Again, at this time, I really just don't know how this is going to play out.
Is it any clearer of the Governor Branstad put this forward also as a way not only to make it more efficient, he claims, but also to save a lot of money, tens of millions of dollars. Can we say at this point whether those savings will be realized? I think they're actually in the Republican budget in the legislature, the savings.
I guess.
Can we count on those savings enough to put them in the budget?
Well, I think initially we can. Right now, the way the contract is set up, the terms of payment from the state to the managed care organizations seem to be held to the point where we certainly won't lose money on these arrangements. At least that's what you would hope. However, the real key here is when the time for renegotiation of this contract occurs. That is, down the road, 18 months, perhaps 2 years from now, the managed care companies will have the opportunity to come back to the state and, based on the two-year experiences they have, ask the state to readjust what they're being paid. And I would be dumbfounded and wholeheartedly surprised if the companies came back to the state and actually asked for less or gave us money back because they were doing so well. In most cases, demonstrated in other states, it's at these points that the companies come back and ask for increases in what they're being paid. And this is exactly where we need good oversight to be in place. Perhaps I would suggest if we don't know what the oversight process is going to occur and how we can anticipate such changes in the contracts down the road, then maybe we should wait until we have a next a governor's election and wait until we get settled in what the new administration might want to do with these things rather than making these decisions on towards the end of the current governor's term.
Okay. Brian Caskey, Associate Professor of Health Management and Policy at the University of Iowa. Thanks for coming in. Coming up in just a moment after a short break, we'll find out why a Des Moines high school got a gender-neutral bathroom, and also how the presidential race is reverberating to every facet of our lives, it seems. How about down to an Iowa high school district playoff game? We'll hear about that when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come this half hour, how this election's anti-immigrant tone is even making itself heard at Iowa high school basketball games, and why a Des Moines high school is getting a gender-neutral bathroom. But first, Tuesday, University of Iowa President Bruce Harreld spoke in a town hall meeting setting on campus at the University of Iowa. If you remember, the selection of Harreld, who is a former IBM executive with no previous experience in university administration, it's been a point of contention on the University of Iowa campus in Iowa City for the past 5 months. Bruce Harreld has been on his job as president for 3 months now, and his critics are still making themselves heard. At the Tuesday meeting, he was met by protesters demanding his resignation and interruptions during his talk. Joined now by Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg, who was there. Hi, Dean.
Good afternoon, Ben.
Good afternoon to you. Give us some background quickly about why this public presentation by the UI president was called for.
Well, from the very first of the people who are dissidents, you might say, or those who don't like the Herald appointment as president, feel that the search process was flawed, have been demanding an open forum and the ability to question President Herald in an open forum. And after 3 months, as you've said, on the job, he had committed to that early on, but it hadn't been scheduled. So this has been scheduled for about a month, and there were leaflets being passed out, I know, on the very day of the forum last Tuesday, inviting and encouraging people to get over to that auditorium, which seated maybe 250 people, and there were standing room only. And Bruce, I was sitting in the rear row. I got there early to set up my recording equipment and so on. I'm sitting in the rear row, and President Herald, I noticed carrying a sheaf of papers and came over to the back row where I was sitting and said, hello, Dean. I said, hello. Hey, how are you? And I said, what you got there? And he said, well, there was a person out here handing out these leaflets against me. And he said, I walked up and said, can I help you pass those out? And he handed me the entire sheaf. And so here was President Herald walking through the auditorium, handing out these papers that were anti-Herald.
There's one way to meet your critics head on. Volunteer for passing out their leaflets. So tell us more about the atmosphere at this event. We heard about jeering from your reporting earlier this week. Was this just the odd person standing up, or was this a sustained protest throughout the, 2 hours?
Well, I can't say how many protesters were there, but when you get enough people to chant and interrupt, it is disruptive to the entire forum. And after about 15 minutes, that chanting began because the one person said a forum is not a monologue. And President Herald had opened up with a series of PowerPoint slides showing things on enrollment and other things statistically on the university ranking and things like that, and people weren't having that. They wanted the chance to question. And even during this PowerPoint, there was a woman sitting way down in the front row, and she had a sign that said on one side, resign, and the other side said, go to hell, Herald. And she was alternately flipping that around and, in fact, raising it so high that it blocked a portion of the PowerPoint screen.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit of President Herald from Tuesday at this meeting. And let's listen to President Bruce Herald of the University of Iowa at this open forum.
More than anything, I understand the skeptics. I live with them every day. I don't have all the experience, but I also say there's a lot of experience in the room. Let's get going. And I would also say I'm not running for office, for goodness sake. I think you've had a series of situations where people might actually be more worried about what they're doing next. And I'm 65 years old. I'm at the other end of my career. I think there's some very significant issues to deal with here in this state and at this institution. And by the way, I'm an optimist. I wouldn't be here if I weren't optimistic about the ability and the talent. And if we could focus it and get beyond living in the past and start moving forward.
Okay, Bruce Herald there. In the minute we have remaining, wrap this up, Dean. Was this meeting a success?
I would say yes. He's trying passionately to develop rapport, and that passing out the leaflets is one thing, while still maintaining the dignity of his office. And I asked at the Regents meeting yesterday, asked President Bruce Rastetter to give an evaluation. He said that one of the Regents, Pat County of Des Moines, was at the session and gave a feedback. And he said, President Herald is doing everything that we ask him to do. We're asking him to meet with every stakeholder group the university touches, and he's doing that. And he, I should say, too, there was also a positive atmosphere at that forum, as mm-hmm. well as the disruption. There was sustained applause at times for him.
Okay, Dean Borg, thanks for the update. Iowa Public Radio correspondent Dean Borg. Thanks. It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations about news items we didn't otherwise get to during the week, to end this week. The presidential race, it seems, is reverberating into every facet of our lives. How about this story? Monday night at the Iowa High School Class 3A district playoff game, Dallas Center Grimes students started chanting Trump and directing that chant at the rival Perry High School students. Now, enrollment at Perry High School is nearly half minority, so the playoff game is becoming a lesson in sportsmanship and racism. National News picked up this story. Perry High School principal Dan Mauberg is with us. Hi, Dan.
Hello there.
So what actually happened?
Somewhere during the game on a couple different occasions, as the game was going on, and it was a tightly competitive game, tightly played, and a few fans from Dallas Center Grimes started the chant of Trump, 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 aimed at our kids, and our kids took it as, more of a racial slur than anything else, and probably based upon, in this politically charged climate that we have, of the things that Mr. Trump has decided to aim at our, aim at immigrants here. And we have many, many immigrant families here in Perry.
Mm-hmm. What is the minority makeup of your high school population? Is it many Latinos or others?
Right. We have many Latinos. That's makes up about 90% of our minority kids, which is about half here at the high school. Most of those kids are coming out of El Salvador, Guatemala, Mexico. We do have some East African kids. We've had Bosnian kids in the past. We don't have any right now. But most of our minority kids are coming out of the Latin American countries, but many of our minority kids have known nothing but Perry schools. We do have a newcomers group every year of about two or three dozen kids through the years that are learning English and have moved here from those countries. But we have many, many kids that were born here that they just happen to be of Latino descent.
Mm-hmm. How did your players respond, the Perry players, when faced with the Trump, Trump, Trump chants?
Yeah, it's as the players will tell you, when they're in that game and they really don't notice that. I think it's after the game and as they meet with their fans and the kids and they really got to know what happened after that game and they did such a great job. Our kids did such a great job of banding together in the face of this adversity and hopefully we can move on.
Has this sort of thing happened before to Perry High School students, given their high minority population?
It happens. I've been here 21 years, and when I first came, we had about six immigrant students in the building, and now we're way over 70 immigrant students in the building. So, but it has happened. We run into two or three incidences like this a year. I think this is different in that the political atmosphere that is out there right now and the caucuses that just happened and things like that with Mr. Trump. So,
mm-hmm. You had conversations in the meantime after that game with the coaches and administrators at Dallas Center Grimes?
Yes, we did. And actually, to their credit, when the chants went up, they immediately stopped them. They got that chant out. And kids can do this. They can, when you're dealing with a large crowd, you don't know what's going to come out next, and you hope it's not embarrassing. But Dallas Center Grimes Athletic Director Steve Watson stepped right in front and stopped it as soon as he heard it. So we had another incident that they couldn't stop, which was on our way out. They were chanting USA, USA at our kids. Assuming that our kids weren't born in the United States, which many of them are, but I was there for that one, and we were able to get that stopped fairly quickly. But we run into incidences like this every year. This one just happens to be different, I think, because what they were chanting.
Mm-hmm. I understand Perry had another playoff game last night. Is that true?
It is true. Yeah, we played Boone last night.
How'd it go?
We got a big win. Our kids played very, very well in a very good match. We won by about 15 points and had a very large crowd.
Congratulations on that. None of the problems in the earlier game this week?
None of the problems. I think Boone did a very good job of talking to their kids. We talked to our kids relentlessly about what was happening. And a really neat thing happened yesterday morning, which was Dallas Center Grimes sent up representatives from their student council and sat down with a group of kids from our athletic council. And, they took responsibility. Our kids said, hey, That's all we needed somebody to do. Thank you very much. And we had kids actually from Dow Center Grimes sitting on our side last night. We had kids from other school districts around Central Iowa came and supported our kids, which was really great to see. You know, something they didn't have to do, but it really opened some dialogue.
This is an unusual and highly charged election season. Many of our listeners would be interested in how that's reflected in the hallways and the cafeterias of high schools. Your high school, for instance, when you patrol the hallways and talk with students, how much evidence is there what we hear on the campaign trail?
Yeah, you know, we are a direct reflection of society here in our hallways, and I can tell you, we have many kids that are scared. They're fearful of the rhetoric that is out there, the anti-immigration talk that's out there. You know, we're one of the few schools in Iowa that probably has a plan of what happens when and if immigration would come in and take some of our parents. You know, we have a plan for that, and not every school has something like that. But our kids get fearful. They see the news. They see the rhetoric. They see the rhetoric from our own representatives here in the state of Iowa, out in western Iowa, and what he says. You know, those are topics of conversation that may not go on in every school, but they do happen here.
You have a plan if the executive order put forth by President Obama should be rescinded by the next president. And you're saying that undocumented workers, the parents of many of your kids who were born here in the U.S., if they should be deported, you have a plan to take care of these kids?
Yes, we do.
Can you briefly outline that?
Sure. It is something where we meet not only with town leaders, but among our faculty, and we try to make sure that our kids are taken care of, that they have a safe place, that we know where all of them are accounted for if their parents were to be taken. This isn't anything new. This happened to Postville years ago, and we learned our lesson from that. Marshalltown had this happen, and we kind of learned our lesson that we need to have something in place to make sure that our kids are safe if their parents are taken. But again, we're a unique school for Iowa, so we have to make plans like this.
Is there any disagreement in Perry about those plans that you just put forth?
There wasn't at the time. And again, we made these plans, I think it was after the Marshalltown raid, I think that was 5 or 6 years ago at the time, and there wasn't any. We had, I think we have some pretty progressive thinking here. Our community has really started to embrace. We've had our issues. We've continued to have our issues at different times, but we did not get any resistance to that plan.
Mm-hmm. What are the kids affected? Are they fully aware of this plan? And the kids and the parents, how do they react?
Right. Well, we ran it by parents, made them aware. We have a pork producing plant in town, Tyson. We made sure that they were included in all of this. Our kids probably aren't made aware until something like this happens. We don't go out there and say, hey, here's our plan for you. What we have is a plan and a structure in place that if something were to happen during the day, on a weekday, when their parents are at work, that we have a plan to make sure our kids are safe.
Okay. Wow. Thank you very much, Dan Mauberger, a Perry High School principal. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Perhaps you've picked up on the conversation across the country about where transgender students, now men or women who identify as a different gender than the one they were assigned with at birth, where they should, relieve themselves when nature calls. And it became a topic of debate this month after the South Dakota Senate passed a first-of-its-kind bill requiring students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that align with their biological sex. That's a bill waiting for the governor's approval. Here in Iowa, in a related story, Roosevelt High School in Des Moines will be getting a gender-neutral bathroom, a unisex bathroom that either gender can use before the end of the school year. Zoe Wagner is joining us, a student at Roosevelt. She started a petition back in November to install such a facility. She joins me now. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. When and how did this conversation start?
So this conversation started last October, late October. Ironically enough, I was using the bathroom and a student walks in. This student he's transitioning to male. He uses a male name. He has male pronouns and he wears clothes that society would deem as something that a man would wear. Yet he had to use the female restroom. So he moved so uncomfortably and, you know, so quickly that there has to be a reason other than not knowing where the men's restroom is as to why he's been using the girls' bathroom.
And did you talk with him at that moment?
I didn't know. We were both kind of minding our own business in that situation. We were both in the bathroom. But his story is not unique from a lot of other kids' stories.
Right. How many transgender students would you say attend Roosevelt in Des Moines?
Well, I can't give an exact number, you know, because, you know, a lot of kids might not feel comfortable coming out or, you know, publicizing that. But we do have a transgender population here at Roosevelt. We have a population of quite a few kids that don't really feel comfortable using she or he pronouns. They go by them. And they don't adhere to the gender binary in one way or another.
Mm-hmm. So the bathroom, now you approached the administration, the principal there. What was the reaction? It was a positive one.
It was positive. I'm very lucky to, you know, attend a school that is very progressive and is very accepting and open-minded in that regard. So I sat down with Principal Biggs, and he said yes immediately. He definitely had a full heart when it came to the situation.
Mm-hmm. And what we're talking about here is a repurposed bathroom. It's not going to be a bathroom that's created, and it's a single room. It's not a room full of stalls. It's one, a single unit, right?
Yes. Yeah. So this is a single unit bathroom. It locks from the inside, and, you know, it's just a regular old one-person bathroom, and it's close to staff members, so that way if, you know, a safety concern happens, any like harassment or bullying, there can be an adult nearby.
Mm-hmm. Safety is a concern you had here on behalf of the transgendered people at your school. Have you seen or heard instances where safety is an issue? Bullying?
Well, bullying is, you know, is prevalent in any high school when it comes to, you know, any kid that sticks out in one way or another. Roosevelt, we're pretty lucky because of the big diverse population at Roosevelt when it comes to, you know, gender or social class or race. We don't really get a lot of harassment here. But, you know, then again, I'm white, I'm straight, I'm cisgendered, and I don't think I can really speak on behalf of students that might have it a little tougher, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, what is the feeling? What is your sense of the feeling since, you know, Roosevelt has how many students approximately?
About 2,600.
2,600. You can't know 2,600 opinions. But what is your sense of the acceptance of this? Is this approved of, or are there some there saying, we don't need this?
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, there's, as you can even see in the political campaigns that are going on right now for president, there's always going to be hateful people out there, but that certainly shouldn't stop us from trying to do what is right. About 9/10 of the students here, I would say, just from my own experience and my own, you know, witnessing it, are pretty positive about it. You know, some students still don't understand what the term transgender means. They don't understand the gender binary, but you know, there are a bunch of really accepting kids here.
Mm-hmm. There may be some listening right now who just don't get it after this short conversation we've had. So to conclude, Zoe, tell us, someone who really doesn't understand, say, we've had male and female bathrooms for generations, and now we need a third type of bathroom? Why, Zoe?
So in my opinion, and I'm sure in the opinion of a lot of other students here, no reason for a student not to feel as safe and as welcomed here as possible. I guarantee that this is not going to affect them. This is not going to affect children that don't identify as transgender. It's simply a way for the kids that do to feel like they belong here because they do.
Right. Zoe Wagner, thank you very much. A student at Roosevelt High School in Des Moines started a petition back in the end of October, November-ish, to install a gender-neutral bathroom, which is coming to Roosevelt High School. Zoe, thanks for the background on this.
Of course. Thank you so much.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.